Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Finding Happiness in a Complex World, Rules from Aristotle and Aquinas, by Charles P. Nemeth, J.D., Ph.D., LLM, narrated by Lyle Blaker. Preface. The quest for human happiness is a universal hope and ambition. Everyone seeks happiness over other negative states of being. In fact, it is an inherent quality, a yearning natural to our human constitution. While some have argued that human beings are by nature inclined to all that is good in life, there are those who speak of the battle between good and evil that gives rise to inner turmoil and conflict, while others observe that our fallen nature, due to sin and corruption, makes happiness an elusive endgame. Whatever vision one might adopt, all would agree that our goal is to be happy rather than distressed or sad, to be content and peaceful with every aspect of life, whether in family or community, love and friendship, marriage and commitment. Everyone everywhere prefers happiness to distress, joy to despondency, optimism to pessimism, and a positive outlook from a life well lived over depression that results from personal failure. Nothing stated here need be corroborated or empirically, scientifically proven. Simple human observation can reach these conclusions. If happiness be so universally sought, why are so many people miserably unhappy? In contemporary culture, the evidence for unhappiness rages like torrents and wild waves in a tsunami in all corners of the globe. To be sure, COVID dynamics do not foster happiness in many circles of human activity. While it is convenient to blame COVID for rising drugs, crime, suicide, and addiction rates, a person who understands the real meaning of happiness will not accept, even during these challenging days, that COVID can really kill true happiness. If anything, a crisis should make us all the more aware of what the real meanings of happiness and joy are. But it is undeniable that people have sunk a bit over the last few years, that their outlooks have been altered to the negative. For this reason alone, the pursuit of true and meaningful happiness has never been more important. The challenges to happiness are everywhere and in every corner of human operations. The opioid crisis manifests more than a mere addiction, but a craving for artificial happiness. Alcoholism and drug abuse have reached staggering levels where millions of American citizens labor under the addictive influence, almost all of it driven by a desire to be happy or to escape what may be too difficult to bear. The general population seeks out psychiatric and psychological help in escalating numbers, all pining for solutions to emotional and behavioral problems, all hoping for some solution to the many underpinnings of sadness and unhappiness. Suicide rates prove directly how formidable this lack of happiness can be, with it particularly tough on the younger citizens, the high school or college student who ends life because that person can find no joy to continue or maintain existence. Even amongst children between the ages of 10 and 14 years, the rates of suicide continue their unabated trek upwards. A recent empirical study of these pediatric suicide rates, based on the analysis of cause of death published by the medical examiners conducting autopsies, paints a frightening picture of children engaged in risky activity, already laden with child abuse histories or other psychological and psychiatric trauma. Remember, these are children between the ages of 10 and 14, and the factors correlating to their suicides are noted here. Percentage of participants endorsing each factor as a consideration in child suicide determination. History of suicidality, 98.9%. Suicide note, 100%. Mood, 86%. Psychosocial stressors, 92%. Alcohol, drug abuse history, 61%. Psychological history, diagnosed mental disorders, 97.8%. Medical history, 92%. Death history of family, 79%. Educational, employment history, 79%. History of child abuse, 79%. history of participating in choking games, 85%, pre-suicidal behaviors, 92%, sexual orientation, 60%. Even more perplexing are the growing numbers of people committing suicide who lack any past history of mental disorder or psychiatric problems. While most research still finds a connection between suicide and psychological and psychiatric conditions, it appears a new and novel breed of suicide participant is impossibly emerging. A blank, emotionless actor lacking past mental disorders that explain the suicidal act. Could it be that modern society is now fashioning or nurturing a new type of human agency that is utterly devoid of the usual and predictable emotional and intellectual qualities once predictive of suicide? Or, as a recent study once opined, that our conclusions about suicide might reflect a bias in psychiatry towards classifying sadness as an abnormal experience? One can only hope this trend never fully materializes. Other trends in suicide, especially among middle school, high school, and college-age students, can only distress, for despite a host of advantages never experienced in older generations, the discontent seems impenetrable. No matter how materially well cared for, no matter how advantaged in school and career paths, no matter how day-to-day needs are never for want, the question of suicide statistically rises. A study of Silicon Valley, California students raised in one of the wealthiest regions of the country with incalculable advantages for a future life manifests data demonstrating a 10-year suicide rate for the two high schools in between 4 and 5 times the national average. The study tackles many controversial rationales for the enhanced suicide rates, but it speaks loudly on how material success, in and of itself, cannot foster an environment of self-worth, self-flourishing, and happiness. Similar results were discovered in an upscale Connecticut school, and when compared to poorer, far less advantaged schools, the results on suicide could not have been more similar. The results, conducted by Yale's psychiatry professor Sunia Luther, concluded, "At each extreme, poor and rich, kids are showing unusually high rates of dysfunction. On the surface, the rich kids seem to be thriving. They have cars, nice clothes, good grades, easy access to health care, and on paper, excellent prospects. But many of them are not navigating adolescence successfully." The rich middle and high school kids Luther and her collaborators have studied show higher rates of alcohol and drug abuse on average than poor kids, and much higher rates than the national norm. They report clinically significant depression or anxiety, or delinquent behaviors at a rate 2 to 3 times the national average. In addition, addictive behaviors, whether in sex, gambling, or food and eating disorders, are rising at levels once unthinkable, for in each of these behaviors, the void of unhappiness can be filled, at least artificially, and very temporarily. Other forms of mania try, however ineffectively, to foster happiness, like unchecked material possessions and shopping sprees, dream homes and vacations, endless impulse buying and purging, only to repeat the cycle again. All of these behaviors are imitators of happiness, rather than the sum and substance of happiness. So too with the lust for fame and power. One will be happy if one becomes a famous actor or entertainer, a politico with high title and authority, a personality whose face is plastered on every medium, especially on social media. However, all are bound to come up short in that journey to real happiness. So also will the desire for unlimited sex, to live a promiscuous life with partners left uncalculated in a hedonistic frenzy that satisfies merely one facet of the human person, while neglecting so many others. The recent rash of porn actor deaths from suicide makes plain the darkness and emptiness of any world rooted in sexual pleasure alone. Then there are the obsessions over celebrity, that new class of artificial personality whose real contribution, aside from being a personality, is impossible to discover except for the invented celebrity and notoriety. None of this really brings meaningful happiness. Television, movies, and video games also are treated like distractions and stopgap measures in a world fraught with unhappiness. New religions and movements, new spiritual fads and cults, try to pave over the holes as well. All around us, the world witnesses a population in deep distress, as active shooters and killers roam our streets with extraordinary regularity. The role of faith and belief under traditional religious definitions, especially the Judeo-Christian ethic, has been swept away in favor of suspect theology. Church attendance rates continue their downward spiral, replaced with relative stream-of-consciousness spiritualities like Kabbalah or Scientology, all of which are incapable of vanquishing or replacing the truth about God and creation. Marriage occurs far later in life when compared to historical realities, if in fact it occurs at all. The procreative function and propagation of human life has undergone a radical transformation by and through abortion, artificial birth control, abortifacients, the morning after pill, and the day before pill. Children are born in smaller numbers as the nuclear family continues its slow trek to extinction. What children are born are either lavishly spoiled due to overattention in the mold of parachute and helicopter parents, or severely neglected due to the parents' negligence, selfishness, or treatment of offspring as incidental nuisances. At every juncture of human life and human operations, we encounter individuals and the community under moral, physical, and spiritual challenge. To soften this void, we engage every sort of ism as a substitute purpose for human life, whether it be environmentalism, communism and its penchant for economic redistribution, materialism as its own good, atheism and agnosticism, where nothing can be demonstrated and thus cannot be believed, egoism, that narrow and exclusive pursuit of self-interest as one's only aim or purpose, nihilism, which purports that nothing in reality is provable, or moral relativism, which denies absolute, universal, and perennial ethical principles in favor of a transient, almost whimsical moral order. Each of these schools of thought falter and foster a personal and communal unease, and even desolation, all at the expense of happiness. Our politicians, our church leaders, our entertainers and sports stars have let us down in immeasurable ways. Congress and other governmental authorities have even lower popularity than hardened criminals. No one has much faith in once vaunted and respected institutions, whether it be the Catholic Church's handling of the sexual abuse crisis or the self-enrichment tactics of congresspersons and senators. None of these conditions lead to human happiness, yet this is precisely the current merry-go-round the world provides. At a whirling pace, the inhabitants of this planet encounter these forces and movements so briskly and speedily that the human agent cannot properly adjudge most of it. Modern life has become so tumultuous and inexact that it is no wonder there are so many who are depressed, so many who end life prematurely, so many who need intervention to cope, and so many who must prop themselves up using artificial mechanisms to be happy. For high school and college students, the problems are becoming more than acute, and more so as the COVID crisis labors on. After a lifetime working with young people, from middle school and high school students to undergraduate and graduate students, and even at the doctoral level, I have gazed upon this steady and inevitable decline in my students' well-being since 1977. I have no faith in any current or modern fad that holds itself as a remedy for unhappiness. In fact, I have never been more convinced that real, meaningful happiness should not depend upon the modern potions bandied about for personal contentment. Indeed, these attractive alternatives work for but a moment in time, and the remedy needed has to be of stronger and longer-term mettle. I have also researched, studied, and applied these fundamental questions in a host of writings and lectures, and keep finding myself coming back to two of the West's greatest thinkers, namely Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, both of whom have elaborate and highly developed examinations of the concept of happiness. I am firmly and resolutely convinced of their current relevancy because both thinkers offer up an unrivaled blueprint for human fulfillment, a plan worthy of our admiration. Both thinkers studied and systematized happiness in ways that have contemporary meaning. Aristotle's masterpiece, The Nicomachean Ethics, a work so significant that Aquinas wrote a massive commentary on its wisdom and applicability 1,500 years after its authorship, delivers a recipe for human life and human happiness. The Ethics lays out the processes that lead to human productivity and flourishing, key elements on the road to happiness. Aristotle's examination of happiness, which he terms eudaimonia, is totally complemented by Aquinas's treatise on happiness, a part of his massive Summa Theologica. In Aristotle, we encounter a pagan believing in many gods, while in Aquinas, the angelic doctor and most formidable intellect in the history of Christianity, a Catholic representing the dogma and doctrines of his faith with accuracy and intellectual brilliance. Both seriously address the question of human happiness and contentment. Hence, this short text is a recipe for life, or rules for a happy life, fully grounded and dependent upon Aristotle and Aquinas. It is a mix and formula for human happiness that may be meaningful to those in search of a more tranquil state. Unfolding in the chapters to come will be a reliable path to human contentment, personal fulfillment, and happiness. Not a perfect, exhilarating happiness without interruption or pause. Instead, this recipe and these rules deliver the type of peace and tranquility only possible with a clear understanding of the world around us, the place we fit into the overall scheme of things, and the day-to-day steps and questions needed to be taken and posed to achieve a happy life. For Aristotle and Aquinas will pose clear and cutting questions in this search for human contentment, including, but not limited to, will virtue lead to happiness? Will wealth and material possessions lead to happiness? Will fame, glory, honor, and power lead to happiness? Will pleasure, sensuality, and sexuality lead to happiness? Will marriage and family life lead to happiness? Will religion and the spiritual life lead to happiness? From these and many other questions, the listener will discover a pathway, a road, and river that can and does lead to a life filled with human happiness, a world very, very different than the purposeless whirlwind just described. 1. Aristotle and Aquinas. Backgrounds and relevance to the modern world. Introduction. Few thinkers have had as much impact on the intellectual, moral, and philosophical history of the West as Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas. Aside from their prolific capacities to write, to lecture, and to dissect and examine problems in ways scholars simply marvel at, each provides foundational insights into the goodness or evil of human activity. Each grapples with ethical dilemmas, the distinction between virtue and vice, and the nature, purpose, and ultimate end for human existence. From studies of the heavens to biological function, from politics to law and justice, from the temporal to the transcendent, both thinkers make major contributions. And despite being 16 centuries apart, these two thinkers are not only conceptually compatible in most respects, but also intellectually entangled in very intimate ways. For Thomas Aquinas, the angelic doctor of Roman Catholicism, was a great, almost passionate admirer of Aristotle, referring to him as the philosopher, without match or equivalent, that he had encountered. This conclusion alone is remarkable given Thomas's 13th-century reality, where most philosophical and theological studies were highly restricted in the confines of church positions. Just as Aristotle broke with Plato's theory of the forms, where a secondary perfect reality of things existed to a reality-based philosophy, an idea quite radical for his time, so too Thomas, whose intellectual affections for the Greeks and the Romans, in the mold of Plato and Aristotle, Cicero and Seneca, was equally radical. Each thinker displays a mind on fire with ideas and intellectual rigor, and each seems to complement the other. While there is dispute in this quarter, many conclude that Thomas harmonizes Aristotle's pagan conclusions about a well-lived and happy life, using natural reason with Thomas's equal agreement coupled with Christian revelation. Others describe the compatibility between the two as Thomas's successful Christianization of Aristotle, for only then does the philosophical system of Aristotle reach its ultimate and perfect conclusion. What is all the more striking about these two figures, especially when backgrounds are considered, is how close in thought and conclusions, although admittedly unidentical, these philosophical giants are. Aristotle, a passionate advocate of natural reason and its capacity to discover truth, meets up with Aquinas, who fully agrees with the power of reason, and then expands those positions into the revealed and salvific world of Christianity. It may sound trite, but for the most part, each gets to the same destination. For the purposes of this examination, that of happiness, Aristotle and Aquinas travel side by side despite theological differences. In matters of ethics, virtue, the end and good we seek, and most importantly, the road to and achievement of happiness, it would be difficult to find more compatible thinkers. For, as Harry Jaffa points out in his piercing work, Thomism and Aristotelianism, they both reach similar conclusions on those issues central to the question of human happiness, namely, 1. Belief in divine particular providence. 2. Belief that perfect happiness is impossible in this life. 3. Belief in the necessity of personal immortality to complete the happiness intended, evidently by nature. 4. Belief in personal immortality. 5. Belief in the special creation of individual souls. 6. Belief in a divinely implanted, natural habit of the moral principles. These mutual conclusions are more than significant in the matter of happiness, for Aristotle and Aquinas write for neither the pagan nor the Christian alone, but for the whole of humanity. Their observations lay out a recipe for human existence no matter what group, ethnicity, religion or creed, nationalized status or citizenship. To do otherwise would be a disastrous formula for the select few. Aristotle and Aquinas write of happiness in universal tones, with worldwide applicability, not by sect or city. Their suggestions for a happy existence are also quite timeless, for what is true for Aristotle in 365 BC was just as true for Thomas in the mid-13th century. For the listener, be assured that these timeless suggestions on happiness have yet to be shown flawed or faulty. None of these recommendations for a happy life go out of favor or change by a fluid relativity, and instead remain constant, permanent, and universal criteria on how to achieve a happy existence. Aristotle, 384 to 322 BC. Aristotle, the greatest and most productive of all Greek philosophers, was born in 384 BC. His father, Nicomachus, a court physician to the king of Macedon, King Amyntas III, died while Aristotle was still a young boy. Aristotle was sent to Athens at age 17 by his guardian to pursue an unrivaled education for his time. For a total of 20 years, Aristotle studied under the eye and guidance of Plato in his academy and eventually became a teacher. Plato recognized Aristotle's gifted academic qualities, though each, while agreement was continuous and constant, did differ on some essential philosophical principles. Plato suggests that the form of created things, what the thing is made of, is separate from the thing that one senses or sees. In short, Plato's world consisted of a perfect template for anything, such as a bed or chair, tree or plant, and what we encounter in the real world, a copy or image of that. Aristotle strenuously moved into a more realistic philosophical position, arguing that the essence or form is in the thing itself. Plato died in 347 BC, but Aristotle was not appointed to succeed him in the governance of the academy. It was a result of his differences with Plato, but nevertheless Aristotle lived in Asia Minor, pursuing his studies in biology and natural history. In 342 BC, he was called to Macedon by King Philip II to tutor his son Alexander, who would become Alexander the Great. While Alexander set out to conquer the Persian Empire, Aristotle, aged 49, returned to Athens and established his own school of philosophy, the Lyceum. At this school, Aristotle lectured, wrote a large majority of his philosophical treatises and dialogues, and collected books, in effect creating the first library in European history. Aristotle was nicknamed Peripatetic, after Peripatos, stretches of main road where he had the habit of lecturing as he walked along the way. In 323 BC, when news of Alexander's death in Babylon reached Athens, Aristotle left Athens and moved to Chalcis in Euboea, his mother's hometown. It was there that he died of a stomach illness the following year. After his death, Aristotle's pupils kept all his writings in a vault for fear of theft. The dampness of the vault somewhat damaged the writings, which were discovered about 200 years after the death of Aristotle. In 86 BC, the writings moved from Athens to Rome, where they attracted a great many scholars, and a new edition of them gave a new rise to the study of Aristotle and of philosophy. Over the decades of his career as a teacher, Aristotle's lectures amassed to nearly 150 volumes. This vast number of volumes soon represented an encyclopedia of the knowledge of his time, and most of the contribution was of his own work. Though he is known as one of the greatest philosophers in the world, Aristotle also worked with biology, psychology, politics, poetry, drama, and ethics. Most, if not all of the areas of knowledge Aristotle investigated, he went on to transform with his studies, observations, and writings. Aristotle developed a formal system for reasoning, which earned him the title Father of the Field of Logic. Aristotle's writings on logic were grouped under the name Organon, or Instrument, derived from the perspective that logic and reasoning were the chief preparatory instrument of scientific investigation. Aristotle's great work Metaphysics raised questions that dealt with things that make us human, from the definition of ousia, or being, to what constitutes matter and form. Aristotle begins Metaphysics with a sketch of the history of philosophy, which he believes grew from the feeling of curiosity of the world. The logical inquiries of Metaphysics stem from its central questions of being, things, and what makes things, things. For Aristotle, metaphysics deals with the first principles of scientific knowledge and the ultimate conditions of all existence. Aristotle observed the world and wondered at its movements. From his observations, he realized that everything in the world, from rocks to plants to humans, is always busy as it continues to be itself, to advance or preserve itself, something that is not necessarily a theory as much as it is the reality of the world. In Metaphysics, Aristotle introduces the idea of form and matter. Matter is the underlying structure of changes, in which there is something constant as things change in growth or decay. It is the potential of something, the capacity to change. It is contingent and without specific qualities. Once it is actualized, all the potentials of the thing are realized, then it is identical with form. The development of potentiality to actuality was intended to help the earlier thinkers with their questions of existence and its beginnings. Though known for his philosophical work, Aristotle made great contributions to the fields of botany, zoology, anatomy, embryology, and physiology. His great observation of nature that lent him knowledge found in metaphysics also assisted him in the knowledge of the human body. Unable to study the internal structure of the human body, Aristotle studied animals, dissecting over 50 different species, thus founding the science of comparative anatomy. His most significant contributions in philosophy, however, relate to his virtue theory and his analysis of proper ends and goods for the human person. His masterpiece, The Nicomachean Ethics, is still considered by many to be the seminal work on virtue theory, as well as a plan for a well-lived life. Of particular interest to this examination of happiness is how proper judgments about human conduct are best derived from reason rather than the will, and how reason instructs or guides us on the proper courses of conduct in human life. In addition, his ethical works keenly and precisely examine a series of virtues and vices and comparatively lay out the results of choosing either. In fact, the most significant insight posed on virtue theory is that it discerns the mean of human activity as the norm, nothing in excess or deficit in most cases. By mean, we do not imply a simple middle or compromise position in human activity.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?